Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. On the first part of the show, we speak to filmmaker and journalist Kevin Pena about the ongoing repression in Haiti. He speaks about the need for people to go beyond the master narrative where history only started after the earthquake. On the second part of the show, we speak to Walden Bello, author of Food Wars. Walden speaks about how hunger is spreading globally, even in countries like Canada and the U.S., not because of lack of food, but because of global agreements and speculation on our food supply. He speaks about what citizens should and are doing to fight back against this brutal global food system that puts profits before people. Stay tuned.
We're very privileged this morning to have Kevin Pena. Kevin Pena is a journalist. He's also a filmmaker, and he's been covering Haiti for several years now. We're very privileged to have him in our studio. Thank you for joining us, Kevin.
Thank you, Sylvia.
Now, the stories of Haiti tend to be driven by what's popular. You know, there is a mass earthquake, and so it gets covered for about a week. But I think that this is a story that, you know, deserves deeper consideration. And I want to talk a little bit about the story of democracy, because I think there are certain things we take for granted in our society. And I wonder if you could paint a picture for us of how the myth of democracy has been played out in the story of Haiti. How has this society been affected by this dominant narrative that we live in a democratic society, that our government's role in Haiti has been one of helping, you know, and assisting people who are in need?
Well, of course, the Haitian people fought long and hard for the principles of democracy. They overthrew the dictatorship of the Duvaliers in 1987. And really, it was a popular movement of the majority of the poor, because remember, in Haiti, like many other Latin American and Caribbean countries, you have a wealthy elite who controlled the majority of the wealth of the country, and then you have a sea of people who, in Haiti's case, are living in extreme poverty. When they overthrew the dictatorship, of course, that let in the military. The military was supported by the U.S. government. That led to successive dictatorships, one overthrowing the other, always ending up on a C-150 flight to the Dominican Republic. And it's no accident, of course, that it would be a U.S. plane that would fly them out of the capital over to Santo Domingo, because it was really the U.S. who, behind the scenes, had trained, as in, again, most Latin American countries in the Caribbean, had trained that military through the School of the Americas, and, of course, the CIA having long ties with having several key military people, key security people on their payroll. All of this eventually led to 1990, when they knew that they couldn't keep the genie in the bottle, that they were going to have free and fair elections. Those elections at that time were agreed upon by the Reagan administration, believe it or not, before the senior Bush took office. And it led to Haiti's first free and democratic elections, where a young Catholic priest, Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide, was elected with 67% of the vote, the highest plurality of any elected head of state in the history of the Western Hemisphere. Of course, we know that his first administration only lasted 6 months. The U.S. then green-lighted, through certain key elements of the military, yet another military coup d'etat in Haiti. And after only 6 months in office, Aristide was ousted in a brutal, brutal military coup. During that coup, he was forced into exile in the United States for a while, for 3 years, and the military became a killing machine. The people began to resist, but more importantly, what happened is that the military, which, of course, as I said, the United States had a huge investment in, began to break up into small fiefdoms over the illicit cocaine trafficking. They began to tear themselves apart, and it was for that reason that ultimately Bill Clinton ordered 20,000 U.S. troops into Haiti, ostensibly to return democracy to Haiti. But what we saw was that the Pentagon and the Clinton administration did not disarm the death squads that had overthrown Aristide, did not disarm the brutal military that had overthrown Aristide, and instead let them keep their arms. Aristide returned and he disbanded the military. He retired every rank except the marching band. Were the only ones who kept their rank within the Haitian military officially. And then Aristide began to try to garner some sense of independence in Haiti, break the role of the CIA as well. But then by that time, his mandate had expired. He had spent 3 years in exile, and whereas the people had said, well, if he spent it in exile, then those 3 years should be returned to him, the U.S. Embassy said, no, while he was in exile, we treated him like the head of state, therefore he was the head of state, that counted toward his mandate, therefore he must retire. So Aristide was forced to leave his post in 1995, and then of course came the election, the first election of René Préval. René Préval won those elections, and the jockeying for power continued. In 2000 was another set of democratic elections where Aristide ran a second time since returning from exile. And again, he won overwhelmingly, this time with 80% of the vote. And that began his second term in office. And we, of course, know that in February of 2004, he was overthrown a second time. But this time, there was no military in Haiti. So what we saw was through agencies like the Canadian International Development Agency, through the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, we saw a new kind of coup d'etat, not a coup d'etat where the military seizes control of the streets by guns and force, where the military seizes the radio station and the TV station. Instead, what we saw were thousands of workers and so-called non-governmental organizations who began to penetrate Haitian society and began to work with the elite in that country, who they then called civil society. Overnight, what was the wealthy elite who had created this huge chasm between themselves and the poor, overnight, through these myriad of NGOs, they were transformed into this new entity called civil society. And for some reason, their rights became greater than the rights of the majority of the poor, who had elected, through the democratic games, one person, one vote, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And remember that same year, while the U.S. was lecturing Haiti about democracy, because what had also happened in those elections, or in the previous parliamentary elections, was that out of 7,300 elected positions, because they were national elections, in May of 2000, which were municipal elections, federal elections for the parliament, and this is prior to the presidential elections, what had happened was out of 7,300 elected positions, 8 members of the Senate who were elected were said to have been put into office without having had a runoff election. Well, rather than just addressing those 8 seats, the U.S. government, in particular, remember Jesse Helms was still alive then, what they said was that Aristide was acting undemocratically, that he was stacking the deck, that there had to be a second set of runoff elections for those 8 seats. But rather than negotiating over those 8 seats, the Organization of American States, which we can say is a proxy of the U.S. government, and the U.S. Embassy, tainted those entire elections, calling Aristide democratic, thus giving this so-called civil society, which was really window dressing for the elite, the moral justification for then calling for Aristide's resignation and building a movement that was not a movement of the poor, but rather a movement opposed to the movement of the poor that was only possible through millions and millions of dollars of money that was provided by the United States, France, and Canada to create an opposition movement to a democratic government, as well as to create the illusion of a popular movement in the streets that really was through the largesse of foreign funding that gave the appearance of a large movement calling for Aristide's resignation.
What you said is of key importance for us because, as we have seen, Latin America has long acted as the laboratory for policies to be tested and then implemented on a wider scale. I think what has been happening in Haiti is a salient example of how you destabilize a country by denying the right to govern themselves, but you also, at the same time, create a proxy system of privatization system. So talk a little bit about the significance of having a government that is run where 80% of their services, health, education, are being run by private companies rather than being state, you know, mandated.
Well, of course, after Aristide was ousted in 2004, people like to think that that coup was non-violent, but the truth is thousands and thousands of Haitians were murdered by the Haitian National Police, backed up and with the approval, the tacit approval of the United Nations giving it cover. Remember, United Nations Security Council resolution, despite the fact that Aristide was democratically elected, basically gave the green light to put in foreign troops into that country in order to, quote-unquote, restore democracy. Well, as I had said before, there was this plethora, this army of non-governmental organizations that had helped to contribute to creating the climate and the justification and the cover for overthrowing Aristide's government. Now, certainly, after Aristide is ousted, they come on even stronger, because it's important that even though this was a movement that was anti-democratic, it was important to present it as representing democracy, while, of course, presenting the majority of the poor who were part of the Lavalas movement, which is known as Flash Flood, which was Aristide's political movement, demonizing them and presenting them as anti-democratic, despite the fact that they were the ones who played by the democratic game and democratic principles time and time again, only to be met with coup d'etats. There are these ideas out there, these narratives, if you will, one which is the dominant narrative, which is currently in place in Haiti today, which, of course, as you rightfully say, represents privatization, which really is code for representing and keeping in place the power of the local wealthy elites, because who else are you going to consider in a country like Haiti the private sector? You're not going to consider the majority of the poor, who are really the electorate, the private sector. No, the private sector are business people like Andy Aped, like Gregory Mebs, like the Aquas, the Haluns, the Bijos, those same families who have been responsible for coup d'etat after coup d'etat in the history of that country, who arguably have been the main reason that there's been such political instability in that country, anti-democratic behavior in that country. Overnight, they are now being the ones who are supported as the democratic elements, while the majority of the poor, the lumpen masses, if you will, of Haiti, are now demonized, and the same NGOs who are working with the well-heeled elites, of course, are afraid of them. That's why today, after the earthquake in Haiti, I've got friends who are just aghast, Haitian friends that I'm talking to, who are saying, Kevin, there are 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds who are coming to Haiti ostensibly to help us rebuild our lives after this massive earthquake. We know the earthquake January 12th killed more than 200,000 people. There are nearly 2 million people who are homeless in the streets. The rainy season is upon them. There's disease in these homeless camps. But what he said to me was, look, there are these 20, 30 somethings who are using Haiti to build their resume today. They don't speak the language, they don't speak Creole, they don't understand our history, they don't understand our culture, yet they have in their hands the lives of tens of thousands of Haitians, and they know nothing of our country. And so Haitians right now are reeling against the fact that not only is there this new generation of people who are working for non-governmental organizations, you remember the Peace Corps, right? Well, people used to use the Peace Corps. Young white kids used to use the Peace Corps as a way to build their resume. It looked good when you came back to the United States to have it on your resume. Well, Haiti's being used the same way today, despite the fact that they don't speak the language and they don't understand the culture. It's a great resume builder. Well, at the same time, of course, the people themselves are being cut entirely out of the process of participating, of deciding what their future will be, of how the billions of dollars is being raised ostensibly on their behalf to rebuild their lives are being spent, whereas these young people who are coming in, who are in charge of these operations that are affecting their lives, make, literally $50,000 to $60,000 a year. The average Haitian who's homeless, living in these camps, faced with disease, not proper shelter, no proper food, no proper water, have no livelihoods whatsoever. It's as if the world is turned on its head. And of course, when we talk about the dominant narrative continues to be that Lavalas and Aristide are evil, despite the fact that the majority of the people in those camps, there are still weekly demonstrations demanding his return. There are weekly demonstrations demanding that the United Nations withdraw from Haiti. They're viewed as military occupiers of the country. That message is completely ignored in the corporate media. It is panned, while at the same time, the main dominant narrative remains that René Préval, who was re-elected, of course, after the coup, and remember, he was Aristide's former prime minister, then he was elected and he was associated with Lavalas. Lavalas elected him in order to return Aristide, in order to stop the political repression after Aristide's ouster in 2004, in order to free the thousands of political prisoners, Lavalas political prisoners who were in jail. René Préval instead has turned around, has worked closely with the international community on this dominant narrative, which basically says that foreign governments, through the aegis of the United Nations, have the right to determine the future of Haiti. And now, of course, that leads us to a situation in June where even the U.S. Senate sees that Lavalas, the majority political party, not participating in the political landscape because Préval has basically cut them out of the political landscape. Not only has he not returned Aristide, but through his hand-picked election council has actually banned Lavalas, the majority political party, from participating in elections. Not just elections 2 years ago and a year ago, but the upcoming presidential elections that are going to happen in November 28th. Well, just this last June, Senator Richard Lugar, led a committee of U.S. senators who realized that if you don't allow the majority political party, Lavalas, to participate, you're only going to be continuing political instability in Haiti. And their recommendation of their committee just this last June, when they were looking at earthquake aid and the role of the CEP and the U.S. government in Haiti in particular, they recommended that Préval allow Lavalas to participate in those elections. And René Préval just this last week got up and said, that's political interference in Haiti's internal affairs, if you can believe it. While René Préval has been participating and working on behalf of foreign policies, U.S. foreign policy on the ground in Haiti, suddenly, when he's going to justify the decision of excluding the majority political party from participating in elections, he's going to call it foreign interference. It's just galling and unbelievable.
I remember a May 2005 World Bank report that showed that Canada was overseeing the decentralization and management of Haiti's electrical system. You know, as you see this wave of privatization, you think, well, why use a destabilization process as, you know, as a tool to enlarge the wealth of the rich? How does it work? How does this construct work? And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the violence, the overt violence that is unleashed on the population and how that contributes to the mass militarization that then follows and continued occupation of the country.
Well, I mean, the dominant narrative continues to be that only the private sector can be the engine for economic development. What that means, of course, is what it's really saying is that only a capitalist model is acceptable, wherein the elites or those who already have the most capital are given preference, as opposed to the system that Aristide was trying to pursue, which was based upon liberation theology, which was giving a preferential option to the poor over the power of the wealthy elite in that country. That was the real argument, and that was the problem that they had with Aristide and why he had to go. He was not going to privatize state-run industries that were turning a profit, and in fact, he was going to take those profits and he was going to invest them in so-called social programs. Under neoliberal economic dictates, you're supposed to privatize state-run industries, but you're never, ever supposed to take profits from them and invest them in universal literacy programs or feeding the population or greater health care. No, instead, that's supposed to be privatized. It's supposed to be sold off to the highest bidder. And who's the highest bidder? They just sold the National Telephone Company of Haiti, right? And they talk about free market capitalists and they talk about the private sector. Well, who bought the National Telephone Company of Haiti? the Vietnamese military. A company that is run and operated by the Vietnamese military now owns the National Telephone Company of Haiti. That is not the private sector. That is the military of a foreign country which has been trying to cater favor with the Pentagon the last 7 years, the last decade. So the argument can be made that the Pentagon is using proxies like the Vietnamese military to buy up private entities in Haiti, if you can believe that. I know it sounds bizarre, but if you look it up, it's absolutely true. So now the state-run industry, the state of Vietnam, runs the telephone company in Haiti, and you cannot call it the private sector, even though it's supposed to be privatization of state-run industries. It's absurd. At the same time, what we're told is that the majority of the poor are unwieldy, that they are prone to violence, that they cannot rule their own lives, and therefore we must deal with sensible people, and those sensible people are business people. Despite the fact that, as I described earlier, it was that same business sector in Haiti that has been behind coup d'etat after coup d'etat and was the main reason for political instability in that country over the last two decades. So I'm not surprised when in the corporate media, all I see today is charities and celebrities. And while those demonstrations demanding that the United Nations leave their country, those demonstrations demanding that Aristide be allowed to return to Haiti from exile in the Republic of South Africa, those demonstrations that are demanding that the majority political party be allowed to participate in the upcoming elections in November, I'm not surprised that the corporate media would not report on them, and instead all you're reading about today are celebrities and charities and how everybody is doing a bang-up job. But really what you're reading is that from their perspective, Haitian history only began after the earthquake. We're not supposed to remember the coups. We're not supposed to remember the historical role of the United States government, the Canadian government, and the international community in destabilizing a democratic government in Haiti. We're not supposed to remember that the movement of the poor is represented by the majority political party, Lavalas. No, indeed, that's why they have this new face, this new generation of directors of NGOs, who I said, a la what used to happen with the Peace Corps, coming into Haiti, because they now become the new official experts on Haiti. And for them, Haitian history began January the 12th, 2010, with that earthquake.
How do people resist? And as you very eloquently have described, we have this dominant narrative that seems to not only permeate the airwaves, but also our consciousness, right? And there is this idea that, you know, the people in power know what they're doing and we should follow. So how do we begin the resistance? Because for me, the first step is being able to stop thinking in this colonized way of seeing the world, that, you know, the servant-master relationship.
Well, I mean, the real question is, when you read this stuff, you have to ask yourself, well, who does it benefit, and whose interest does it represent? When you hear authentic voices of people, of communities on the grassroots level, I think people can distinguish them. Let's take, for example, what's going on with BP right now in the Gulf. BP, of course, is investing tremendous amounts of money in a dominant narrative that says that the oil spill wasn't as bad as it is and that the region is recovering right now. While, of course, there is the counter-narrative of the community, which says something quite different. Those community voices are still talking about the not only short-term impact of the oil spill on their economy and on their lives, but the long-term impact. So while BP has a vested interest in turning the page and making everything look rosy through the dominant narrative, those resistant voices of the community continue to be heard, and we hear them creep up and pop out in the media because they're so widespread and prevalent. I think that people can begin to distinguish between the dominant narrative, which is supporting the powers that be, institutional powers that be, versus the resistant narrative of the communities whose lives are being affected by the decisions of those institutions. And it's those counter-resistant narratives that we need to identify and we need to explore further. And in my case, of course, I feel the need to represent when it comes to the issue of Haiti. They do not have access to the corporate media, yet their voices exist. But if you read the newspapers, if you read the coverage of Haiti, you're not going to see that they exist. Well, I have a commitment to the majority of the poor in Haiti. I have a commitment to those counter-narrative voices of the authentic grassroots communities who are calling for social justice, who are calling for active democratic participation in the decisions of their country. And if they're not going to be heard in the corporate media, then I'm going to do everything within my power through my contacts and through my work in the media to make their voices heard, to help to amplify their voices.
Thank you so much for being with us. Kevin Pena is a journalist. His latest film, We Must Kill the Bandits, is a wonderful film. And I'm just going to end the interview by airing a brief excerpt of that film. So if you could just set it up for our audience.
This is the resistant counter-narrative, whereas no one wants to believe that the United Nations could be involved in human rights abuses because, of course, the dominant narrative that we hear historically is that they are a benevolent force, a neutral force for good in the world. This film provides the evidence as well as the voices of the people in the communities in Haiti who claim that the United Nations was part of trying to destroy their movement, of giving cover and legitimacy to destroying the movement of the majority of the poor after the ousting of Aristide February 29, 2004, including allegations that the United Nations committed a massacre in the community of Cité Soleil in Haiti on July the 6th, 2005.
And tell our audience also, how can they access your film and how can they support your work?
You can go to HaitiInformationProject.net, www.HaitiInformationProject.net. Most of my writings and work are also on HaitiAction.net, and I have a YouTube channel which is called Long Memory Prod, which is short for Long Memory Productions. If you just do a Google search on Long Memory Productions, you'll see many of the videos that I posted that are available.
Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Sylvia. Thank you so much.
President, a coup, and the undying resistance of the Haitian people. Haiti, We Must Kill the Bandits, a new documentary by Kevin Pena, chronicles the human rights situation in Haiti following the ouster of President Aristide on February 29th, 2004.
We go live to Port-au-Prince, where we are joined by our special correspondent, Kevin Pena.
Well, I can tell you this, they were very angry today. I think they caught the U.S. Marines and the Rangers off guard today.
This is a clear case and a shameful case where Canada, the United States, and France joined together instead of furthering democracy, ended democracy.
Haiti, We Must Kill the Bandits documents the horror of a Canada, U.S., and France-led coup d'etat and military occupation by United Nations forces.
Kevin Pena putting his life in front of the guns as he's recording. It is truly an amazing film and one that everyone must see. Once again, it's Haiti, We Must Kill the Bandits. You can Google this. It's also on YouTube.
You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com.